You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, the world's first legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. Hello and welcome to episode 66 of the Study Legal English podcast. I am your host, Louise, and in the next few episodes, we will be focusing on criminal procedure, looking at what happens before, during, and after a criminal trial. If you are a Podcast Pro member following these podcasts, then at the end of these episodes on criminal procedure, you will be able to take a final exam and earn a course certificate. Find out about courses and certificates at studylegalenglish.com/courses. So, in the last episode, I gave an introduction to this topic, and I asked you, do you think the investigation and prosecution of crimes should be carried out by different bodies? And I had a message from Aidan in Brazil who said, I think it's important to have separate bodies for investigation and prosecution. I am Brazilian, and so in my mind, it is recorded that power could not be only in one body. If you think about power, you think about corruption and our reality. Here, there are separate institutions and complex laws. So I agree that the investigation and prosecution of crimes should be carried out by separate bodies. A big thank you to Aidan for sending in that message, and I must say I agree with Aidan too. As we learned last week, in England since the 1980s, the majority of crimes here are indeed investigated and prosecuted by separate bodies, those bodies being the police, who investigate the majority of crimes, and the Crown Prosecution Service, who prosecute the majority of crimes. So, what is the topic of today's episode? Well, today we are going to focus on pre-trial criminal procedure, including the investigation stage and the decision to prosecute. We will look at what happens after a crime has been committed, but before a suspect goes to court for pre-trial hearings and a full criminal trial. You really should know the different categories of criminal offences before you listen to this episode. As a very quick recap, there are the least serious offences called summary-only offences. There are either way offences, which are more serious. And then there are the most serious offences, known as indictable-only offences. To find out more about these offences with specific examples and the types of courts which hear cases related to a particular offence, you should listen to episode 47, which talks about this in more detail. So, let's get started. Firstly, we must start at the commission of the crime. When someone commits a criminal offence, normally the crime is reported to an investigatory body. It may be reported by a victim, or if this is not possible, as is the case with murder, which is an indictable offence, the crime can be reported by a close relative of the victim, such as a sibling, partner, or child. As we heard in the last episode, in England, there are a number of investigatory bodies to whom people report crimes. However, the police are responsible for the majority of investigations. After a crime has been reported, the police will carry out an investigation to gather enough evidence so that informed decisions can be made about whether or not the alleged offender can realistically be charged. If a prosecution goes ahead, this evidence, provided it is admissible and in compliance with the rules of evidence, will be presented in court by prosecutors with the aim to prove beyond reasonable doubt to the jury that the alleged offender is indeed guilty. So, What sort of evidence does the police collect? Well, there are different types of evidence, such as oral testimonies, witness statements, real evidence, and documentary evidence. In order to gather this evidence, the police will likely do a number of things, such as questioning the victim and witnesses, and viewing the crime scene. The police have a number of powers granted to them in relation to gathering evidence, such as stop and search, entry and search of premises, arresting and questioning suspects, and making audio and video recordings for evidence. These powers are detailed in the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984, which is often referred to by the acronym PACE, P-A-C-E. Throughout the investigation, the police may ask the Crown Prosecution Service for advice on what evidence would be required to support the case going to court. As you may well remember from last week's episode, the Crown Prosecution Service is the organisation that is responsible for prosecuting the vast majority of criminal prosecutions. And how the Crown Prosecution Service and police officers work during the investigation and prosecution of criminal cases is set out in the legal guidance prescribed by the Director of Public Prosecutions called the Director's Guidance on Charging. So, what happens after this initial investigation? Well, there are a few options available to the police. Firstly, the case may be dropped due to insufficient evidence or it not being in the public interest to prosecute. Or, for very low-level crime such as shoplifting or graffiti, the police can deal with this quickly and proportionately without charging the suspect and without a prosecution. In this case, there are a number of out-of-court disposals available for the police. Let's take a look at some of these. Firstly, one out-of-court disposal is to give a simple caution. This is a formal police warning which forms part of an offender's criminal record. It is used for many first-time offenders who are aged 18 or over, where they have admitted to committing an offence, and the offence is a minor one. A second out-of-court disposal, commonly used for antisocial behaviour, is to give a community resolution. With a community resolution, the victim is consulted as to how to repair the harm caused. It may be that the victim simply wants an official apology from the offender, or it could be that both the victim and the offender participate in something called a restorative justice meeting. In a restorative justice meeting, the victim and the offender discuss the offence and the effect it had, and they try to reach a resolution. Community resolutions are for first-time offenders who accept responsibility for the offence and where the victim has agreed that they don't want the police to take more formal measures. However, what if these out-of-court disposals are not appropriate? If these options are inappropriate, then the police have limited powers to charge suspects according to the DPP's guidance on charging. They may charge a suspect who allegedly committed a summary-only offence, regardless of whether it is likely or not for the defendant to plead guilty or not. They can also charge a suspect who allegedly committed an either-way offence, where a guilty plea is anticipated. If the case is outside of these circumstances, for example, it is an indictable-only offence, the police cannot decide whether or not to charge the offender. Here, the file will be referred to the Crown Prosecution Service for a charging decision. Regardless of who makes the charging decision, the Crown Prosecution Service must still review the file to ensure that the correct decision was indeed made, and files are continually reviewed as the case develops and circumstances change. In determining whether or not to charge a suspect or to go ahead with a prosecution, the Crown Prosecution Service follows guidance set out in the Code for Crown Prosecutors. The CPS will apply the full code test when deciding whether or not to charge a suspect, which is set out in Section 4 of this code. This is a twofold test, involving an evidential stage and a public interest stage. Let's look at this test in a bit more detail. In the first stage, prosecutors must be satisfied that there is sufficient evidence to provide a realistic prospect of the suspect's conviction on each charge against him or her. With this test, prosecutors consider the following questions. Can the evidence be used in court? Is the evidence reliable? Is the evidence credible? If, and only if, there is sufficient evidence to justify a prosecution, then prosecutors go on to consider the second stage. This is whether a prosecution is in the public interest or not. Here they consider factors such as the seriousness of the offence, the culpability of the suspect, and the harm caused to the victim. If the full code test is met, a suspect may be charged and a prosecution can be commenced. It may be the case that when the prosecutor is deciding whether or not to go ahead with the prosecution, that they consider that an out-of-court disposal is more appropriate, in which case the file will be sent back to the police and the police will use an out-of-court disposal. In very limited situations where the full code test cannot be met, a different test may be applied in order to charge a suspect immediately. This is called the threshold test. And here, five conditions must be met. Firstly, there must be reasonable grounds to suspect that the alleged offender committed the offence. Secondly, it must be possible that further evidence can be obtained to provide a realistic prospect of conviction. Thirdly, the seriousness of the case must justify an immediate charge. Fourthly, there must be continuing substantial grounds to object to bail. And finally, it must be in the public interest to charge the suspect. If the threshold test is used to charge a suspect, then it is important that the full code test is applied and met once further evidence is gathered. At any stage after charging, including at this stage, charges may well be dropped by the CPS or police for a number of reasons, especially due to not meeting the full code test. So, what happens if the CPS do decide that a prosecution should go ahead? Well, a prosecution must be commenced, and there are a few ways to do this. Let's look at two of the main ways. Firstly, there may be an arrest and charge. With an arrest and charge, the suspect is arrested by the police and charged with an offence at the police station. The suspect will either be released on bail and requested to appear in court on a specific date, or he or she will be held in custody before appearing at the magistrate's court. Secondly, there may be a written charge and requisition. Here, the prosecution issues a written charge together with a requirement, also known as a requisition, which requires the defendant to attend court. Great. So now that we've looked at this preliminary stage, let's look at some key legal English vocabulary. Number one, defendant. This is used to describe a person who has been charged with a crime and is being prosecuted. We also use this term in civil law to talk about the person to whom a case is being brought against. Number two, offender. An offender is a person who has given an admission of guilt for committing an offence or has been found guilty in court. If you are talking about a suspect, you must not use the term offender because this goes against the presumption of innocence, which is enshrined in the Human Rights Act 1998, and instead it assumes that someone is guilty before it has been proven. Instead, you should use the term alleged offender, which means the accused person, or indeed, suspect. Number three, suspect. A suspect is a person who is believed to have committed a crime. This person is suspected of committing a crime, but we do not know that they actually did commit the crime. Great. So that's the end of today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget that if you are a Podcast Pro member, you can find all your member benefits for this particular episode at studylegalenglish.com/episode66. In the next episode, we will be looking at the pre-trial hearing process and much more. But before I go, I have a quick question for you. Do you think the full code test is an appropriate test to apply when considering whether or not a suspect should be charged? Why or why not? Send me a message to my email, which is louise@studylegalenglish.com, or just find me on social media. Search for Study Legal English or Legal Englisher. That is Legal English with ER on the end. So thanks for listening and see you next time.